Welcome to Marketing Musicology with your host, Dr. David Allen.
Today we're talking about Coca-Cola with Joe and Umut. Coca-Cola has a long history of sonic branding, which we're going to talk about today. And the most recent sonic logo, Taste the Feeling. Joe and Umut, welcome to the show.
Great to be
Thank
here.
You.
So thinking back, and what do you remember most about the creation of Taste the Feeling?
So creating the Taste the Feeling audio logo, we actually had one talent that did everything, that played every instrument, was every sound. And it was great working with this talent because it always showed up on time. And it was the Coke bottle. You know, we really took every single sound in that audio signature was generated from the Coke bottle. And we didn't use it as an instrument. It's not like we were banging on it and trying to recreate drums. We were really just trying to take the sounds that the bottle and drinking a Coca-Cola make, from grabbing it to the fridge to, you know, pouring over the ice to the fizz to the refreshment. So everything was generated by the bottle. So basically it was an exercise of recording the bottle doing what it does.
And what you know, of all the logos that we're talking about in this series of supersonic logos, it's probably the only sonic logo that the product itself actually created. Do you think that's why it was so powerful?
I wouldn't say it is the only one, because Coke had a big heritage of using intrinsic sounds in radio spots and, like, you know, different times and period. But what I would say, Taste the Feeling is probably one that we put much more strategy and intention on every aspect of it, from the melody, allowing us to be able to sing the tagline, to basically bringing the strategic priority of the campaign, which was reminding people intrinsic pleasure and taste of drinking Coca-Cola, using audio and all types of elements to bring it to life. So we probably, like Coca-Cola, when you look in their existence, they use different elements, different times of the, like different campaigns. But probably we used it with much more intention and strategy, because we had a very specific brief, remind people the simple pleasure of drinking Coca-Cola. And what is better to remind, use an audio soundscape that everyone already familiar from their childhood, from their youth, opening the bottle, hearing the fizz, listening it pour into the glass and the first sip, which is always the best sip.
And I think that's key, Amu. I think that's key, Amu, is that the sounds we use were actually very, very familiar. We all recognize them, just like we recognize, you know, the logo, we recognize the bottle shape. You know, we recognize the sounds, and I think what we did is just put them together in a musical format. But they were, yeah, to your point, they were existing sounds that people, you know, had a connection with.
And that is Coca-Cola's DNA, right? The Coca-Cola traditionally likes to create new sounds, as opposed to getting a favorite artist at the time or just sort of replicating something that they had done before, right?
I don't really think you can pick one pattern in the existence of a brand that is 130 plus years old, because I think each different period in its existence and history, they approach it very differently. Coca-Cola actually is one of the brands, probably the brand introduced what is called music endorsement to its first form and shape, with engaging a bar hall singer. Joe would tell you the story a little bit better than I can do, but Joe, do you want to tell the
yeah,
first?
It was 1895. A woman named Hilda Clark was a singer, and she was used in print ads. I mean, it was like a painting of her, and she was the first endorser for Coke, and she was a music hall singer. Then a few years later, they used a singer named Lilia Nordica, who was more of an opera singer. So they had sort of the highbrow and the quote-unquote lowbrow, they called it, dual sort of strategy. But this is back, you know, this is before, you know, this is before, you know, before Spotify, way before Spotify.
And they, like, you know, when you look at Coca-Cola, like a brand like Coca-Cola, they did everything, you know, well, one point in time, they did printed music and stuff like that. So I don't think we can say we are the first to basically, you know, use either the sound elements or, you know, some sort of catchy tune to in a combination. But what I can say is we both, Joe and myself, love history a lot. And when you are basically working with an iconic brand like Coca-Cola, one of the first things they do is they send you to the basement, which is one of the biggest corporate archives in the world. And you see how basically the same story has been told over years. So what I think we did is we had the luxury to pick and choose what we loved the best, what we felt people connected the most. And we brought it all together, you know, as organically as we can. Like, you know, it was not just the tagline singable, the soundscape used. We also engage up and coming talent to basically sing the part. Now, our bet was that gentleman would be the next Bruno Mars, which, you know, in Australia, he absolutely is. But he didn't break internationally, you know, as much as big as we want him to be. But we basically used so many different elements and tactics. It was like a very fun project for us to collaborate. And I think probably between me and Joe, it marked our 10 year of collaborations when we did the Taste the Feeling. So it was almost like we were a very well-rehearsed team that basically know both sides of the story. And we basically had a great time, you know, digesting all of the learnings that Coca-Cola had over 130 plus years and basically bringing what makes sense in today's world.
Not surprisingly, that most of the people that we're talking about for this book always thought that sonic branding was an important thing, but more so that sonic logos, even more important today with smart speakers and limited attention spans. I'm assuming you guys agree with that?
Well, I like to say, if people recognize your brand when they see it, are they going to recognize it when they hear it? Because people, the audiences, are spending over 40 hours a week listening, whether it's music or podcasts or audiobooks or voice devices. When we start shopping on voice devices, that changes the entire dynamic of how people connect with the brand. You know, you're getting into a year, 2020, where half of all searches on Google will be voice searches. So what that means is that all the beautiful iconography, the packaging, the logos that were done, they don't translate into an audio environment. So I think audio sonic identities, you know, more comprehensive approaches to sonic identities are a must for brands today.
I couldn't agree more. Look, you know, audio is going to emerge as the next interface in next 5 years, 10 years. We already having all my lights in the house is basically a voice comment. You know, when I want to hear the news, I'm asking to hear the news. So what's going to happen is our screen time will start going down because audio is much more intuitive. You know, I'm not needing to look into my phone to give a command or read the news. I'm asking my Google Assistant or Alexa to tell me the news. Then there's going to be commercials in between those, but, you know, it is one thing showing like a new car on a banner ad or a TV, like a pre-roll. It's another thing reminding a brand using audio to people and what that brand represents to you. Like BMW, for example, has certain brand elements that, like, you know, you would never hear it on audio or see it on the audio unless some marketeer, intelligent marketeer, like thought about it and say, you know what, we are modern, we are this, we are that. We need to bring audio clues together in a way that, like, you know, when someone hears this audio or sound or whatever, that is what the emotion it awoke about my brand. And I think that's, I think the next phase of audio branding is similar to what we have done. It's not just a catchy tune. Like, you know, there are so many bad catchy tunes, like glorified jingles out there. But does that make you feel something about the brand? Yep. If you say Liberty, Liberty, Liberty Mutual 10 times, people will remember that was your ad. Great, you check one of the boxes. But I would argue, as marketers, our job is to build relationships, emotional relationship with our audiences. And I think what marketers will need to do more and more is like find effective ways to, articulate what the brand stands for more efficient ways. And audio is one aspect of it. Audio logos and audio melodies. It just like, you know, we started introducing, audio style guidelines 5-6 years ago together with Joe and our time at Coca-Cola, which was like people didn't initially understand why would we need a style guide for melody. Well, because there are increasing different ways your brand will need to interact with the audience. And the way you have a design style guideline to tell you what not to do next to each color or how to draw that box or logo, you need that for audio as well. Like, because there are, like, you know, we're talking about the high end of smart speakers, but your brand will still need to exist in gazillion different places, be it a TV spot, radio spot, in store, if you have a smart device, and which we are seeing more, we're gonna see more and more, a fridge that might have an audio cue teed up to it. So yeah, it was a long way to say it, but I agree with Joe.
So you can go back to 1920s, you know, when Coke first went on the radio is when you start seeing like Coke use music and sound. And it's funny, the taste, the feeling, the approach we took, which is the intrinsic sounds of Coke, the bubbles and the ice and the sounds of Coke, that was actually used back in the 40s and 50s as well, because we were putting out the same messaging into the market. So back into, you know, the 40s and 50s, the messaging around Coke in the U.S. was have an ice cold Coke. It's refreshing. So they wanted to talk about the product a lot. So they actually used a lot of sounds, especially because radio is a big, means to advertise. So they used a lot of those sounds. Then you got into the 60s, and in the 60s, you know, there was a campaign called Things Go Better with Coke, which was the more of a tagline, of a lyric tagline that was given to the music industry. And artists like James Brown, Aretha Franklin, The Who, like massive artists, created songs called Things Go Better with Coke. And they use that line in all different ways in their music. So that was sort of a really interesting one. In the 70s, of course, there was like, I'd Like to Buy the World a Coke, you know, which had the song, I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing. You know, so those two things lived together in the 70s. In the 80s, you had Always Coca-Cola, which was very, very popular, very, you know, memorable jingle. So there's been a lot of uses of, music. And I think, you know, when you get into Open Happiness was one of those, you know, sort of, I think, just really defined that era of Coke, you know, like those other ones did, I'd like to think, you know, because of the way it was, you know, adopted and used in pop culture. But to Umut's point, Taste the Feeling was very specific. You know, we had gone back to that, you know, very product-centric marketing. We wanted to remind people about the product of Coke. And Coke, when you look at it, you recognize Coke when you see it. You recognize Coke when you hold the bottle. The actual brief to create the contour bottle over 100 years ago was they wanted a shape that someone could touch in the dark and recognize. So you could recognize Coke when you see it. And you recognize Coke when you taste it. Coke has a very unique taste. You know, the flavor profile of Coke is actually very unique. It's hard to replicate. And you recognize Coke when you hear it. So we wanted to go back to that. Let's make sure people recognize Coke when they hear it. And when you hear Coke, to Moose's point, earlier, we took the entire journey of, if you listen to what is on that video, we took the entire journey from like opening the fridge, grabbing the bottle out of the fridge, taking the bottle, you hear ambient noises because you're hanging out with people, it's social. You get the bottle, you pop off the cap, you hear the cap fall, you hear the fizz, you hear the liquid pour over the ice, you hear it crackling, you hear that, you know, that sort of white noise that the fizz makes. Then you hear the gulp of the drink, and then you hear the ah. So it's the entire like experience of drinking a Coke that we captured. And then we had to sort of, you know, put it into different, you know, time lengths to fit different uses. But it's, yeah, it's very much, you know, it was, I'll try to find some videos, but it was definitely something that popped up quite a bit in the 40s and 50s.
What Joe explained in terms of the story is actually the precursor of Open Happiness. At the time when we launched Open Happiness, which was a very different campaign than the previous campaigns, which was received magnificently well, and it was exactly when I joined the global team at Coca-Cola, we had this update meeting to the CEO of the Coca-Cola, Muhtar Kent, at the time, to tell how great we are doing as marketeers on you know, this campaign. We had all the TV spots, you know, and this is basically the campaign which introduced the happiness factory, the iconic happiness factory. And there was like so many amazing commercials, like, you know, in the portfolio with that campaign, including a TV spot with Jack White, etc. So it was like very interesting. But CEO listened to all the presentation and said, like, guys, apologies. You guys as marketers are telling me this is the best campaign of all times. But if you look at historically all of the Coca-Cola campaigns, you can hum the campaign. I can't hum this campaign. There is no melody associated with it. And it was then that we basically get the challenge from the CEO and we look back and said, oh, you know what? He's right. All of the iconic Coca-Cola campaigns over its existence is associated with a melody that you can't forget. Like, always Coca-Cola is part of my childhood. It's impossible. Like, you know, I might forget all the TV spots that I have seen around Always Coca-Cola, but I will not forget that melody. I won't remember one TV spot with that campaign, but I will remember that melody. And as marketeers, at that point, we realized, oh, yeah, like, we have to have a melody that's basically what will make the campaign more memorable and remembered. And as marketeers, and when you're working at a brand like iconic as Coca-Cola is, you know, spending billions of dollars of marketing, it's not what you're doing today, but will it be remembered in the history of the brand as well? So we started the journey.
Remember, remember Can't Beat the Feeling? That was another one that was just so driven by music. The whole campaign was driven by music.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that was basically, when you look at the times of, like, you know, what here's the thing. TV spots, technically speaking, is an annoyance. People do not connect with the TV spots. But music is something, or melodies is something that's so ingrained in our hearts, in our mind, it's something that allows us to connect with either be it the message or the brand. So I think that goes all on the same under the same umbrella. It basically is a very effective way to create affinity and get people to connect with the campaign. So once we get the mandate from the CEO, we start the search like every other company would do. Okay, let's bring some music houses. Let's basically start bringing some demos in and stuff like that. But also, one thing we realized at the time, one of our TV spots was charting, like getting scores off the chart, which was Happiness Factory. When you basically, and in at the time at least, and I'm sure they change it a million times, when you look at the score of a TV spot, you'll basically break it down to different elements, what it's like, why it's like. And one of the things on that TV spot, on the first Happiness Factory TV spot, was the melody. People just love the melody. It was obviously very lovable characters on the screen as well, but people really love the melody. So we basically, after doing a long journey with the film and production department of Coca-Cola at the time, we come to the conclusion the best melody we had in our hand was the melody that we already started using with the Happiness Factory, because it's also one of these things when you're introducing a melody like this one, especially in an international scale, it's not always easy to get buy-in from international markets. And now we had this TV spot that everyone is wanting, and it was scoring everywhere so well. We said, okay, it just makes sense. Let's basically convert the five notes melody that is being used in this TV spot to our audio signature. Now, because it was more of a tactical move, perhaps a reaction, no one really thought about, oh, can you sing the Coca-Cola brand name in the melody? Or can you add a message or tagline, something like that, with it? So it was much more reactionary versus strategic. But it worked out because it was such a catchy tune. And we basically managed to develop and build it throughout the years in a very effective way. Well, once again, I'm going back to the same story. One of the things at the time, basically, when the time came for us to launch the melody, we basically wanted to make it famous. We were working with the second installation of Happiness Factory when we were ready to launch. How can you make a melody famous? We said, okay, what if we bring few artists that already is in pop culture that our audience love? We create a song that is almost extension of the campaign, but it is an actual song, almost like a single. If we use this as a launch platform to launch the melody, it probably will be better than just launching with a TV spot. So in conjunction with that, we did a single that featured CeeLo Green, Janelle Monáe, Fall Out Boy, Panic at the Disco, Travis McCoy from Gym Class Heroes. And actually, that is the origin story, how Joe Belliati and Uzu duet started, because it's the first project we collaborated, and we were we always make this mind trick with people. Joe was the agency at that time, and I was the client. I was basically head of music partnerships at the time at Coca-Cola, and we basically did this, and it was super successful. We were in charts all around the world with this melody. So it's progression of the same basically success. So basically we launched this, it was very good. Then the following year we had World Cup, and we basically, everyone turned to us and asked us, okay, World Cup is coming. It's our biggest campaign yet to come. You guys did a great job with, launching the new audio logo in form of a single. Can you guys do something for the World Cup campaign that basically will bring it even further? And we basically couldn't stop thinking, oh my God, like, this is actually a very good chant, because you can, like, it's very chantable. So we then followed in and did another song for the next campaign coming in for the World Cup, which was still part of the same campaign. So you don't need to change, the audio logo. And we did another song that basically a call for celebration, which basically our hope was will be chanted at the stadiums, which, it's a rare case in marketing. You start with a vision and you actually realize it. It happened. So next probably 8 years or so was basically, oh my God, this is basically a great way for us to launch campaigns and make people.
Well, I will say, before you skip 8 years ahead, I think it's worth mentioning on Wave and Flag. The reality is that was one of 40 things that were created for that campaign from marketing assets. 40 is not the accurate number, but probably 40, from digital assets to mobile to visuals to experiences. I mean, there's tons of content. I mean, it was the biggest campaign Coke had ever done. So there's a lot of marketing assets. And the music got no more attention than anything else. It was one of 40. And the reason it became one of the most used by Coca-Cola during the time, and the reason it became, you know, number one song around the world was because people gravitated towards the music. We didn't put any more media, or we didn't put any media around the song itself, except, you know, it was in a few commercials. It wasn't like we pushed the song into the market. It was really people gravitated towards it, which was amazing because, you know, they liked the song, but it was also from a marketing perspective, it was an amazing value because we got so much out of it for, you know, relatively small investment when you think about traditional marketing.
Absolutely.
Okay, and on that note, we're going to thank and say goodbye to Uma and Joe. Thanks, guys, for spending time with us today.
Cool, thank you. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. You ask the right questions and poke into the right stories. Can't wait to hear how it comes together.
You've been listening to Marketing Musicology with Dr. David Allen.